And I could not be more excited about the opportunity to speak with a sports broadcaster by the name of Anne Liguori. She has hosted a number of different interview programs to great acclaim, and has covered in particular the sport of golf that she loves above all others extensively. And so perhaps you have heard her commentary and her interviews with various golfers. And I am so glad to be able to connect with Anne Liguori to talk about her most recent book, which is called Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. And in this book, we hear essentially some of the interviews that Anne Liguori has conducted with some of golf's greatest luminaries, men and women both. And essentially, it is an exploration of what it is like to be an elite professional golfer and the lessons that one is apt to learn along the way. As is stated emphatically early in the book, golf is the sport that teaches us so many life lessons, teaches us the greatest lessons in life. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Anne Liguori about this really great book published by Hatherly. Anne Liguori, we welcome you to the morning show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's always interesting to interview somebody who is in the business of interviewing others. And it only just occurred to me that it must be kind of interesting for you, as typically the person firing questions, to be the one to whom questions are being fired. What do you make of this kind of role reversal that happens whenever you're publicizing a new book or undertaking?
Yeah, that's a good point, Greg. I mean, I'm used to asking questions and doing my research on the person that I'm interviewing, and to turn the tables is interesting. I mean, I'm getting more used to it, but, you know, I've always been curious about people. Growing up, I always wanted to do exactly what I'm doing, hosting shows and interviewing different personalities in sports and entertainment. And, you know, so to kind of reverse those roles is quite odd, but hopefully we'll get it done.
Very good. So one of the things you tell us in the introduction to the book is that you actually had aspirations to be a sports broadcaster from really early on. In fact, you write at one point, since I can remember, and that was at 3 years of age, I've always wanted to be a broadcaster and interview fascinating people. Explain how such a thing is possible. I mean, we just don't often hear about a youngster having that sort of aspiration, and particularly at a point in time when there probably weren't a whole lot of role models you know, for you to be looking at and emulating.
Exactly. I mean, who at 3 years of age knows exactly what they want to do? It's just insane. But my earliest recollection is being in a high chair, watching. My mother must have watched this noontime show hosted by a true trailblazer, Ruth Lyons. I grew up in the Midwest, and I was born in Cincinnati, and we moved to Cleveland when I was eight. But at this time, I was watching Ruth Lyons, who was a true pioneer. She hosted a variety show, and she would interview the most fascinating personalities that came through Cincinnati. And it made, obviously, such a lasting impression on me. It just goes to show you, you know, how young people can be so influenced at such an early time, right, in their lives. And I was. From my earliest recollection, I've always wanted to do what Ruth Lyons did, and that is interview different personalities. And, you know, I grew up as an athlete. I competed in a variety of sports in high school. And before that, all the games were played in the backyard with the neighborhood kids. And I was often the first one picked on athletic teams because I was a naturally gifted athlete and I could run fast. And so I was always very athletic. So when I, you know, pursued this broadcasting passion of mine, I somehow always knew that it would be sports broadcasting, that I would be most passionate about and pursue that because of my athletic background. So, yeah, at a very early age, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And all these years later, I'm still doing it.
lucky you. I also want to make sure that I acknowledge something that leapt out at me, because actually my full-time job outside of the radio station is being a music professor. So my eyes lit up in the introduction when I read that, in addition to all of this wonderful athletic prowess, that you also played the flute in the marching and symphonic bands in your high school. And I'm always happy, and of course, and I especially enjoy, you know, the voice students that I teach, who not only were wonderful singers in the choir, but also maybe the quarterback on the football team or whatever. And I'm just so happy to see that music, at least at that point in your life, was an important part of your life as well, and probably gave you some balance.
Oh, absolutely. I was a very balanced young lady, thanks to my parents and the incredible foundation they laid out. And both my parents were college professors. So education was very important. Being balanced was very important. Music was very important. I took piano lessons from the time I was 8 years old. And actually, I hate to say this, but I quit taking piano lessons so I could join the bowling league at school. My mother wasn't too happy about that. But I continued playing the flute and loved the marching band, played in the symphonic band. That was in high school. It was really my brother Dan, my younger brother Dan, that got all the musical talent. And he continued. He's a professor in college as well, but continues to play gigs whenever he can. He's based in Florida, and he travels all over the country performing. So he's the one that got the true talent. But music provided me with such a great balance and background, and I have a true appreciation for music, for sure.
Very good. And of course, music manages to teach us a few valuable life lessons as well, but that's maybe for another book. The book, of course, at hand is about some of the lessons that we can learn from the game of golf and from great golfers. And of course, that's the heart and soul of your book, Life on the Green. One other thing from your introduction that I want to touch on. You kind of outline some of the various programs that you have hosted over the years, beginning, I believe, with your show, Hey Liguori, What's the Story, on radio station WFAN. And you mentioned that you were the first female talk show host on the station. I wonder what that was like. I mean, and I can imagine a couple of scenarios, including one where maybe you were not universally welcomed, that there would maybe be certain listeners, maybe even certain colleagues, that might kind of have trouble wrapping their heads around a woman hosting that kind of a show. What was that like?
All of the above is correct. it was very difficult. I was the first woman to host a sports call-in show on the very first all-sports radio station, The Fan, WFAN, and this was in 1987. And, you know, it was just so rare. And, you know, the traditionalists did not like it. They weren't going to have it. And so, yeah, there was a lot of backlash, but, you know, I kind of ignored all the negativity, and certainly there was a lot of positivity along the way as well. But, you know, I put a lot of pressure on myself to be totally overprepared for every show, you know, to study more, to research more, to be better than, you know, the host before or after me or whatever, just so I could obviously enhance my career. And yet I put a lot of pressure on myself because I wanted to perhaps help other women pursue careers in sports media. And I knew that if I didn't do a good job, that not only would it hurt me, but it would hurt the chances of other women. So I took it very seriously back in the day, and I still do. But the show kicked off on July 4th, 1987. Doc Gooden was my first guest. I knew I had to get a big guest, and it was a coup just to get him because he had just gotten, you know, he was a key player for the New York Mets, and they had just won the World Series season, you know, in 1986. And I was able to get an exclusive interview with him. He had just gotten out of Smithers rehab, And he wasn't really supposed to talk to anybody, but I was able to connect with him and tape an interview with him before the station was even on the air. And I used it as my very first show. And we started out with a bang. It was July 4th. And that show aired for 25 years, Greg. Just amazing. Wow. I was on every week for 25 years. Hey, LaGuardia, what's the story?
That's terrific. Do you have any recollection of the circumstances under which you were given this opportunity? I mean, I'm sure you earned it, but I mean, the station that hired you, WFAN, do you recall this being, in a sense, a very conscious gesture on their part that they wanted to give such an opportunity specifically to a woman to maybe enlarge the audience or whatever? Or wasn't it really about that? Was it just about you being the right person at the right time with the right talents, just given this show? And the fact that you were a woman was, in some respects, beside the point. Do you have much recollection of that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's more that than anything else, which is incredible because the early programmers of the radio station really did not see gender. I didn't think they did. And they heard me on ABC Radio Network. I was a stringer, as they say, you know, a correspondent covering every team in New York. So I was already on a network covering the Mets, the Yankees, the Jets, the Giants, any tennis event that came through Manhattan at Madison Square Garden or at the U.S. Open, any golf event that came in the New York metropolitan area, college hoops I was covering, track and field. So I was really a generalist back then, covering every sport that was that happened to be going on in New York for ABC Radio Network and producing, as a freelancer, Howard Cosell's show, Speaking of Everything, and having great stories about, you know, working with the great Howard Cosell. And so I was pretty much chalking up a lot of incredible experiences early in my 20s, having just arrived in New York City right out of college. I had a byline. I was writing sports for USA Today, so the executive saw my byline. So I started my career out, you know, with a lot of national fanfare, so to speak. And so when WFAN, the first all sports radio station, was putting their programming schedules together, they basically interviewed me for the job. And you want to hear a funny story? I did not even hear back from them that I got the job. Minor technicality, I read about it in the newspaper.
So, wow.
It was just bizarre, those early days. Yeah, I read about it in you know, a radio TV column in the sports pages of the Daily News. So, yeah, it was quite extraordinary, but was very happy to get the opportunity. Now, fast forward maybe a year and a half later, they ended up firing 25 people, including the women that they hired. And they said they overpaid and overhired. And so I went from a staff position with benefits and you know, et cetera, to a freelance position. But I was able to maintain the show, even though, you know, the situation had drastically changed. And I continued to host that show from a freelance standpoint for 25 years.
Wow. Wow. And by the way, there's another little interesting point in your biography, and I promise we're getting to the heart of your book in just a moment. But you mentioned in terms of the array of sports that you played that one of the things you did was that you played on the boys' tennis team because your school at the time did not have a girls tennis team. So
that's right.
At least once before in your life, you had had the experience of, in a sense, you know, crashing a party. That's not the right way to put it, but you know what I mean. I mean, you know, kind of stepping into an arena and making your place, making your way. And that was probably an interesting experience as well.
Yeah, I think you put it perfectly. I did crash that party. you know, there were, after Title IX was passed, suddenly in my high school, there were varsity sports that girls could compete in. You know, obviously they had to try out and make the teams. So I, as a naturally gifted athlete, competed in volleyball in the fall, basketball in the winter, track and field in the spring. But I loved tennis, and they did not at that time yet have a girls' tennis team. So I tried out for the boys' team, and I made the team. And by the time I was a senior, I played number one singles on the boys' tennis team. So, yeah, that was great training, just learning how to compete with and against guys and all the ups and downs that comes with that territory. And it was obviously really great training ground for me to be a woman in the sports broadcasting industry, especially starting out in the mid-'80s when there were very few women given opportunities to host shows in sports. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Anne Liguori, and we're going to be talking now about her newest book, which is called Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. As I said in the introduction, in a sense, the book is based on one very emphatic statement that you make repeatedly in the book, namely that golf is a sport in which we are able to learn all kinds of valuable lessons, the relevance of which extend way beyond the golf course and the game of golf. I'm just curious, first of all, when that sort of revelation first occurred to you, that in a sense golf is about more than golf, or golf teaches us things about more than the sport itself.
Sure. I mean, I didn't play golf when I was a kid. I did all these other sports. I didn't really have the opportunity to play golf. And I took it as an elective at University of South Florida, PE elective. And then when I eventually was hired to host a show on the Golf Channel, another first 24-hour network, focusing on a sport, I started getting all these invitations to play golf in charity tournaments, celebrity tournaments, and I thought, you know what, I really need to learn this game. And so I wish I would have learned it as a kid, but I didn't learn it until I was in my early 20s. But as soon as you pick up the sport, you see that golf is a microcosm of life. It teaches you so much about life that, that's what the book is all about. It's basically, I interviewed a dozen legends, six men and six women, and it's all about what they bring from their iconic golf careers to life. It's all about their life wisdom. And it's a universal language. It's hard to play golf. It's a very frustrating sport. It might be the most difficult sport of them all. Just ask Michael Jordan, or just ask Wayne Gretzky, or Tom Brady, or some of the greatest athletes at what they do in their respective sport. They are so humbled by golf. But it certainly is a microcosm of society, and that's one of the reasons why golf just intrigues me and so many other people so much, because it does possess so many life lessons that carry over. Hmm. And it's a life learning sport. You can never perfect it, and it just teaches you so much about yourself and about others.
Hmm. At one point you write, the sport that is all-encompassing and maddening, yet inspiring and enriching. So you also call golf at one point a most cerebral, spiritual game. It forces us to examine ourselves, challenges our life, challenges us, it pushes us. And it sounds like you think this is exceptionally true for the game of golf versus other sports. What is it about the sport of golf where this is true, or why this is true?
Well, I think you have so much time to think in golf. It really is a mental game. They say it's at least 75% mental. You're standing on top of a stationary ball. You have so much time to think. So much can go wrong. So much can go in between your ears before you hit that ball. And you hit it, and then you go to where you hit it, and you try to hit it again. And it's just a very cerebral game, meaning psychologically it is very, very challenging. So much can pop into your head before the shot, during the shot, after the shot, some of the best advice from the professionals, you'll hear them talk about stay in the present. We want to do that not only on the golf course, but off the golf course as well. Don't worry about that shot behind you, that bad shot you hit. Don't worry about anything that happened in your personal life that wasn't great. You know, you just think of, stay positive. Nancy Lopez is one of the legends in the book. She talks about staying positive, which is so hard to do on and off the golf course. You have to stay positive. It's so easy to hit a bad shot. You see the pros missing short putts. They practice night and day, and they still can miss a four-foot putt. So certainly amateurs can do that as well, seeing the pros do that. But you have to stay positive, and that transfers to off the course as well. You know, with all the ups and downs in life and the challenges in life, it's so difficult to stay positive, but that's a great message in the Nancy Lopez chapter. Just, she says, play happy golf, meaning stay positive no matter how challenging, no matter how frustrating it is. And it is very challenging, and it is very frustrating. And stay positive in life as well. And if you can carry that over to off the course, it's very hard to do, but staying positive is such an important message.
Hmm. So explain who these particular golfers are, whose thoughts and insights are shared in this book. I mean, each given their own chapter. I mean, are these your favorite golfers, or golfers with whom you have an especially close connection, or who had things that you found especially compelling to say? Why is it these particular great golfers who comprise this book?
Sure. I mean, there's so many talented legends out there, right, who have great stories to share and lots of wisdom. But I decided, you know, I wanted to go with Hall of Famers. All 12 of the personalities in the book are in Hall of Fame. And they're all major, you know, they all are huge winners in the sport. They're all a little older, so they have had plenty of experiences on and off the course. So I wanted to interview people that could look back on their careers and share sides of themselves that you might not have read before or heard before, and who have lived, you know, the ups and downs, and can share what some key takeaways are, key moments are. Of course, Jack Nicklaus, you know, the winner of 18 major titles, he is just phenomenal. I mean, his chapter is about integrity and sportsmanship and keeping family first. And, you know, he said his family surpasses anything on display in a trophy case or etched in bronze. I mean, golf obviously is important to him because it gave him a great living and a great lifestyle. He said, my life is all because I made a couple four-foot putts. But he truly believes in being a father. That comes ahead of chasing a trophy. And in that chapter, he talks about integrity and sportsmanship. And he and Barbara Nicklaus, his wife, do so much for charity. Jack Nicklaus has 5 children, 22 grandchildren, 3 great grandchildren. And, you know, his kids have always been his priority. He would play in a tournament, Greg, on in the third round on a Saturday somewhere. He'd fly back to Florida that night to go to his son's football game, and then fly back to the tournament Sunday morning to be there in time for his, you know, for the final round. I mean, that's how important family is to Jack Nicklaus. So yes, all the messages are different in each chapter, and I picked personalities who are very positive role models, who have a lot to say in our divisive time in our society and even in the sport of golf. I wanted it to be very positive, very uplifting. So I'm very proud of the fact that it really is a positive, uplifting book. And the 12 legends that I chose are those kind of personalities. They're just wonderful role models, and they had a lot to share in the wisdom category.
They certainly did. One of the things I really especially appreciated was some of the illuminating background information on many of these golfers. For instance, a golfer by the name of Amy Alcott, whom I had certainly heard of, but I did not remember ever knowing about a really crucial moment in her life and career when the matter of eyesight was raised, and this ended up making a huge difference in the success that she was ultimately able to achieve. Do you mind sharing that story with our listeners?
Sure. Amy Alcott, I love. Her chapter is called Be the Captain of Your Own Ship, and I love that because, you know, she didn't come from a family of golfers. Her parents were very supportive, but she basically initiated golf on her own, learned on her own, you know, did a lot of things differently than most kids back then. And she told this great story that she was playing in a tournament, and actually she was training with her coach, getting ready for a major junior tournament. And her coach told her, just aim for the pin up there. And she looked up, and she told her coach, where is the pin? She asked her coach, where is the pin? And she wasn't that far away. She was within maybe 120 yards from the pin. And he said, you can't see that pin? And she said, no. I just normally aim for the middle of the green. And he realized at that point, she realized at that point that her vision was so terrible and that she needed to get her eyes tested and wear glasses. And isn't that amazing that she had such talent at such a young age for this sport, yet she couldn't see 100%? And so that changed. Obviously, her game got a lot better after she, you know, got glasses and contacts. But I just think that story is amazing that her vision was so bad, yet she played so well as a junior.
Absolutely. I also appreciate, speaking of inspiring, some of the background you give us on South Africa's Gary Player, who you call South Africa's greatest sportsman and golf's most passionate ambassador. One of the things you tell us about Gary Player is, of course, he comes from a nation with a whole lot of trouble and turbulence, especially at the time when Gary Player was a famous golfer and apartheid was still firmly entrenched in his homeland. And you tell us about all of the ways in which Gary Player really worked tirelessly, both publicly, but also very much behind the scenes. I mean, working with blacks and on behalf of blacks, trying to make their lives better. And although I'd maybe heard a little bit about that, I feel like it's with your book that I really understood for the first time. First of all, the kind of difficult position that Gary Player found himself in, and the really courageous and compassionate way in which he confronted some of these issues.
Oh, yeah. Gary Player is an international treasure. I just adore him. He's 88 years young. His chapter is Pursue Your Passion, which he continues to do at his age, and he does it with so much passion. He plays golf every day. He exercises daily. I know because I did a TV show with him a couple years ago, and we were doing push-ups and sit-ups in the living room together. I was trying to keep up with him. But yeah, I mean, he gets into the serious issue of, you know, apartheid and growing up in South Africa, and he would invite Lee Outer to South Africa, which was unheard of to invite a black golfer, you know, to South Africa in the height of apartheid. And so he took a lot of criticism for that. And even back in our country, when people knew all the work he was doing to try to, you know, bring more black players into the PGA Tour and into professional golf, he'd get harassed. And he had a lot of trouble in this country because he was helping black players. So Gary always put his life on the line and reputation on the line to further causes that he believed in. And he's such a great interview, Greg. If you ever have a chance to talk with Gary Player, he is just so brutally honest, and I adore that about him. He says what's on his mind. It might not be politically correct at times, but he's not afraid to express his opinion, and that to me makes a great interview.
Oh, absolutely.
And Gary Player is just a wonderful, wonderful loving human being.
Yeah, and one of my favorite lines in his chapter is when he says, golf teaches us, or maybe you say, I don't remember now, but golf teaches us honesty. I mean, so to whatever extent Gary Player is an exceptionally honest person, at least some of that comes from having played and experienced the game of golf.
True, because golf is the only sport where a player calls his or her own penalties. There's no other sport like it. If you make a mistake or have a penalty, you have to call it on yourself, even if nobody's looking. So it really exposes one's honesty. And, you know, you test yourself. Should I admit that I, you know, did something that was against the rules, that was by truly unintentional and purely accidental? People still have to admit that they've done that or call that penalty on themselves. It's just an incredible sport. So, yes, it teaches you honesty and teaches you so much. And again, his chapter is called Have a Lifelong Passion for What You Do and Have Love in Your Heart. He's a humanitarian, and he truly believes that, you know, we need to love each other and support each other and make this world a better place. He has traveled the world more than any other golfer in history. He's played all over the world, and he has a lot of experience and a lot of wisdom that he's garnered from traveling to all corners of the earth. I think you'll enjoy that chapter a lot because he does share so much about his life.
And he, you mentioned that he was the first pro golfer to promote a truly impressive fitness regimen. I mean, at a time when, at least largely in the sport of golf, that was perhaps an alien concept. And of course, he probably helped transform the game of golf because of that.
Absolutely. I can remember when I was younger seeing a lot of overweight golfers. And a lot of golfers, you know, had pot bellies and smoked and drank. And, you know, you're walking at least four rounds a week. You're playing in practice rounds earlier in the week in pro-am tournaments. You're walking perhaps 7-8 miles a day. You have to be in great shape. I don't know how some of these golfers were able to do that back in the day when fitness wasn't paramount and when nutrition wasn't, they weren't as educated about good nutrition as they are today. But yeah, Gary kind of set the trend in that department and went into the gym, and he, to this day, continues to work out. He's just amazing. He's just, you know, the epitome of fitness, and he eats well, and he shares his wisdom. He spreads the good news about doing all that and staying healthy well into your later years.
Can I ask you about two other golfers real quick?
Sure.
Okay. So I really love the very first chapter in the book, in which you speak with a marvelous, eloquent golfer from Ireland. And I think it's a great way to lead off your book with some of what he has to offer. Tell our listeners about chapter one of your book.
Padraig Harrington. I love Padraig Harrington. He's from Ireland. He's won three major titles and so many other tournaments through the years. But imagine my shock when he told me that he plays with fear all his life, that he still, to this day, after all the wins, after all his playing experience, when he tees it up, he feels fear, not just nerves, but fear. And he said that fear heightens his focus and brings adrenaline to his game and, you know, makes his game more sharp. But, boy, that is some revelation. A lot of diehard golfers have never heard that. And Padraig was honest enough and just incredible to open up about that. He also feels that he's been underestimated his entire career, which I find surprising because he is so accomplished. But he goes into the details in that chapter of why he feels he's been underestimated. And then the third part of that chapter that I just adore is his mental strategy to the game. And he shares what he has to do, whether he's winning a game or leading around, going to the final round or behind. And I'll keep this open so that, you know, the readers can read this for themselves. But it's very interesting material about how he feels he has to play to close out a match, to close out a win. And, you know, golf is so much mental strategy, as we've been talking about.
Right.
And he almost has to use reverse psychology to close out a win. And I'll kind of leave it at that so I don't, you know, spoil the punchline, so that people can enjoy reading about how mentally he sees playing in the final round so that he can go on and win a tournament.
Right. I don't think I'm giving this that away, what you are, you know, wanting to kind of play close to your vest when I mention something. I think this is a separate point in that same chapter, but that I really like a lot. It begins with something that you say: golf is a game of mistakes, of failures. And so part of it is embracing that reality as an inescapable part of the game of golf. And you quote Mr. Harrington as saying, golf has good and bad breaks, just like life. Dealing with a good break is as important as dealing with a bad break. Getting over it, getting on with it, accepting it, coming back strong, being a good winner or being a good loser. But you know, that notion, I don't know that I've ever really stopped to think about that before. That's the reality for all of us, whether we're golfers or not, that life is full of good breaks and bad breaks, and you better be able to handle both.
Absolutely, and that also plays into the Nancy Lopez chapter, where she encourages all of us to stay positive. You have to stay positive, because you're going to have good breaks and bad breaks. You can't let the bad breaks derail your life, which so often can happen. It's very difficult, again, to stay positive. We all have our ups and downs, but if you can learn to focus on the positive, then it really helps you get through those bad breaks.
Absolutely. And by the way, when you said that, you know, he admitted that he plays the game of golf with fear, and you said something about, oh, you know, we often don't hear that. And I was going to add, we often hear the opposite of that. I mean, lots of coaches in lots of sports, you know, will talk about fearlessness, and that's an essential component of winning. And here is this elite professional golfer saying that fear is actually one of the essential ingredients in his own success. It's just fascinating to think about.
Right. He's being so honest. He is being so truly honest, because all of us have fear, and he learned how to embrace it. I think his message is, we all need to learn how to embrace not only nerves, but fear, and go for it.
Hmm. I also want to give you a chance to talk about Jack Nicklaus. You've already mentioned him as the winner of 18 major championships, and you tell us the runner-up in 19 other majors. I mean, just an absolutely extraordinary career, and someone who demonstrated such integrity and was such a devoted family man, and yet managed to achieve this greatness, very much humbled by the game. You quote Mr. Nicklaus at one point saying, golf is just a game. And this also flies in the face of what we so often hear in other sports, where, you know, there is kind of a almost life and death quality to what is being the kind of warfare that's being waged out on the basketball court or the football field or whatever it might be. And here is this incredibly successful professional golfer saying, golf is just a game. How do we fold that attitude or that notion into the career and success that Jack Nicklaus achieved?
Well, obviously, he kept an incredible perspective. You know, golf can be so heartbreaking. And all those wins he had, but then you mentioned all the runner-up places he finished, all those second places. It's just so heartbreaking. You think you're going to win, and then, whoops, come in second. It's not fun. But, yeah, he just has a tremendous perspective on life. And so much wisdom to share. He spends a lot of time. He has a golf course in Florida called the Bears Club, and a lot of the professional players who live in Jupiter and around are members of that club. And he just loves walking around and shaking hands with these players and sitting down with them and spending some time giving them advice if they ask for it. and sharing his wisdom to these young players. He's just such a mentor to so many of these professionals because he has such a great perspective. As I said before, he said it all happened because he made a couple of four-foot putts. If that's not putting it in perspective, you know, nothing is. I mean, he believed that being a family man came first and taking care of your family. I think I told you he had 5 children, 22 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren. There's a great picture of he and his family at St. Andrews on the famous bridge on the 18th hole at St. Andrews. It's just a beautiful family portrait. And I had the opportunity to sit next to Barbara Nicklaus at an event last week. I was a keynote speaker at a women's leadership forum during the Cognizant Classic, a PGA Tour event here in Florida. And Barbara, his wife, is the most lovely woman. And he spends half the book just talking about Barbara and how, you know, what the key to their successful marriage is and what a key to a successful partnership is and to being a good husband and a good father. And I just find him just fascinating. He's been such a good role model all these years. And he's still going strong. He's still talking to as many young players as he can. He's still a mentor to so many young people. And, of course, you know, he's a husband, a father, a grandfather, and a great-grandfather now. So he's just a wonderful man, and the whole family is just beautiful to know.
What I find so intriguing is that I'm pretty sure the first time we see his name in your book is in the chapter about Tom Watson, who talks about, as a very young man, being thrilled to be able to play with Arnold Palmer, my greatest hero, and then not too long after that, getting the chance to meet and play with Jack Nicklaus, my greatest villain. And it's just so interesting to think about, you know, somebody so highly regarded as Jack Nicklaus being the villain in anybody's sort of view of the world of golf. And of course, Tom Watson goes on to very much revise his opinion of Jack Nicklaus and what he stood for. But it's just so amusing to think of that moniker being attached to the name of Jack Nicklaus.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Tom Watson, his chapter is called Learn from the Best. And he certainly did learn from the best, not only from Arnold Palmer, but before he became rivals on the course with Jack Nicklaus, he would sit there on the driving range and just study Jack Nicklaus. He tried to learn as much as he could from Jack Nicklaus. And then they started playing a lot of tournaments against each other, and they became very, very good friends. And yet they were rivals and have some just incredibly, you know, competitive duels through their history. And, Tom talks about how he can't believe that such an intense rival would become one of his dearest friends, but they are dear. In fact, I was at a wedding. Tom Watson got married last year, and who was there? The entire Jack Nicklaus family.
Oh,
so,
wonderful.
To this day, they are still very good friends.
Well, the book is an amazing array of thoughts and reflections from some of golf's very, very greatest champions. And we haven't even mentioned some of the other greats that are part of this array of great Hall of Fame golfers whose thoughts are collected in your very, very illuminating book. Again, it's titled Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdoms from the Legends of Golf, published by Hatherley and the author Anne Liguori. Anne Liguori, thank you so much, first of all, for giving the world this really delightful book. I really, really loved it. And I'm not even, I hate to say, I'm not even all that passionate a fan of the game of golf. I learned so much and enjoyed your book so much. So I think it's obviously going to be greedily enjoyed by any fan of the game. But even for someone not particularly well acquainted with the game of golf, there is a lot to enjoy here. And I hope a lot of people will seek it out. Anne Liguori, thank you so much for being my morning show guest today. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Greg, I so enjoyed it. And I'm so glad that you pointed that out, that the book is not only for golfers, but I think it's so universal, all the themes, and so positive. And I'm so glad to hear that you enjoyed it. And maybe we'll get you out on the golf course one day. But until then, keep reading Life on the Green, Lessons in Wisdom from Legends of Golf.
I learned a lot and enjoyed it very much and enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks again.
Thank you.